hopefully.
We'll deal also with the Harinam Chintamani chapter 2 and chapter 3. Did anyone not get a Harinam Chintamani? Can you pass this back? Anyone else not get one? We went over Seva Opera Sadhu Nindi yesterday. Also, there's some discussion about there was some discussion in the Harinam, in the Madhuri Kandamini, about the different, considering the names of the demigods to be on the same level as Lord Vishnu, the second opera. I think one interesting point there is that sometimes the Viva sometimes becomes Lord Shiva. Do you ever... Transcendental Party, you can always state that, because most devotees don't know that sometimes the Jiva becomes Shiva. But let's go on to the nullification of the Anarthas, as explained by Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. He says that there are five grades of nullification. What is called Ekadesha Vartame, which means it's limited to one anartha. The other is called Bhavudesha Vartame, it's pervasive. These are just the translations of the words. General is Prayaki, Prayiki. Complete is Purna. And absolute is Atyantiki. These are just general terms that are being used to give us some idea. It's not that they're absolute conceptions. But limited is defined as more or less working on one anartha.
So that's what is absolute, no?
Oh, I'm sorry. Absolute. Limited means to be one anartha, working on one anartha. Pervasive is affecting many anarthas. And the rest is more or less self-evident. So when Namaparad, he states, that at the stage of Vajna Kriya is limited. At the stage of Nishta or Nishnita, Vajna Kriya, it's pervasive. At the stage of Rati or Bhava, it's general. At the stage of Prema, it's complete. And at the stage of attainments of the Lord's feet, lotus feet,
It's absolute.
So can anyone say what this means? Seems that chanting holy name is quite difficult. Get rid of the anarchists. Because if we examine nullification on the other levels, we'll find that, for instance, from previous sins, at the stage of Vajna Kriya, it's general. At the stage of Nishta, it's complete. And at the stage of Asakti, it's absolute. Parabdha karma. Aparabdha karma. So what does this mean? Can anyone say? How can we understand what this is talking about?
Well, Nama Parada is extremely severe or serious. And it's so serious that it sort of infiltrates the consciousness so deeply that it's only when after a person, at least if the Nama Parada is very serious, it's only after a person has made great advancement in spiritual life that they can and come practically to the topmost platform before they could be completely freed altogether of the effect of serious Nama Parada.
It's true. It may apply to this or not.
Question. Is this Nama Parada as opposed to Nama Bas? Or is Nama Bas included within that?
Nama Bas is a stage of chanting. Nama Parada is any kind of fences that we make when we're chanting. In the Harinam Chintamani, the discussion of the difference between Nama Parada and Nama Bas, this is an arc that's arising from. This Nama Parada fences, which later on come to Nama Bas, and then finally Shudranam, Bhavanam, and Premanam. So this is all included. This is more or less, this is the process of getting free from Nama Parada. But then Tracy?
Could we say that the reason why this seems to be more stringent than the anarchist disappearing due to other avarads, like Seva avarad, is because it's through the holy name that we realize the form, the quality, the aspect of
the nation? Yes. That it's by making some serious endeavor to become free from the avarads by chanting the holy name that we advance quickly from one stage to the other. Otherwise, this is actually positive. It's a positive process. In other words, even if you completely become free from all previous sins, you only come up to the stage of a Shakti. But you won't come to the stage of seeing the Lord's lotus feet. Only if you become free from all Nama Parada, you get to the stage of the Lord's lotus feet. So, by making a serious effort to become free from the Nama Paradas, you can go quickly from Vajna Kriyas to Nishta. And if you make a serious effort at the stage of Nishta to become free from Nama Parada, you can advance rapidly to Rati. Yes.
The understanding that I have is that if you perform a Nama Parada, then the effect remains asa manatha within you. And that those anathas, depending on how serious, but if they're really serious, like a serious offense against a Vaishnava or against your spiritual master, then the anatha resulting from that offense committed at some point would still be there, even up to the level of prema. In other words, there'd be some defect.
Well, that's true, but that's dealing with a different topic. In other words, this is, in one sense it is. In other words, this is showing us how by purification This is dealing with purification or nullification of the aparas, rather than the accumulation of them by performing them and gaining narthas. You see the difference?
Well, it's nullifying the narthas.
Yeah, nullifying. In other words, this is the positive process of becoming free from them, rather than the other process of becoming covered by them. That is, if you work seriously at becoming free from them, then you can go from one stage to the next. And the principal process is by the chanting of the holy name. So the holy name is the most merciful in helping you advance. Although it appears it's very strenuous, but actually this is just means. For instance, if I'm chanting with some aparads, or anarthas, that's the result of, I may have some anarthas in my heart, therefore my chanting is not pure. But if I work on becoming free from the anarthas and avoiding the aparads, then the result is that by some, for instance, paying attention, we'll find out in Harinam Shintamani, that especially inattention is a very serious offense, if one can nullify that. So if I pay attention and start becoming free from my inattentiveness, then I can advance very rapidly and even experience, you know, rati or some feelings of emotion by chanting attentively, even if I'm on a lower stage of devotion. Is that clear?
What's the difference between complete and absolute?
Complete means just like there's a slight smell still lingering of that anartha. And complete means that there's completely nullified.
Absolute
means it's completely nullified.
No chance of it coming back.
Right. The word is ganda is used in the Sanskrit. Slight smell at the stage of complete. Just like in the stage of prema, of course, is complete. It's practically, there's no... Prema is actually the complete stage. In other words, at the stage of prema, there's not even a slight smell left of material consciousness. But here it says that one is absolutely taking shelter of Krishna. Especially when we're chanting the holy name, that's the time to make the greatest effort.
I just have a question that reminds me of something else. It's to do with yesterday's topic of Vaishnava. On page 3, about 3/4 of the way down, it says that though the Vaishnava may forgive offenses, the dust of his feet does not tolerate the offenses and delivers the fruits of the offense of a guilty person. So what does exactly that mean about the dust of the feet not tolerating?
It means that Krishna is aware of everything that goes on. And if you offend a Vaishnava, then the Vaishnava may forgive you, but Krishna won't forgive. And therefore, eventually, one will receive the reaction for it. Just like, for instance, when Gopala Chapala offended Srivas Thakur, he went out to the forest because he contacted leprosy as a result of the offense, and he asked forgiveness from Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and Lord Chaitanya said that my blessings is that you'll ride here for millions of lifetimes, kalpas of Brahma, infested with leprosy. So he was a little disturbed. And eventually Lord Chaitanya came back and told him that you have to surrender to Srivas Thakur, get his forgiveness, and then you meet my forgiveness. Or Durvasa Muni, and he took shelter after offending Ambarish Maharaj. He took shelter of Lord Vishnu. Lord Vishnu said that I can't forgive you unless my devotee forgives you. So the devotee may forgive, but unless still Krishna will note it. In other words, the devotee may not take it seriously, but Krishna will note it that unless you absolve yourself by asking forgiveness from the devotee, then Krishna will know it and you'll get the reaction for it. Is that clear? Just like Srivas Thakur didn't take it seriously. He called for all the gentlemen from the neighborhood and told them that just secretly at night I'm worshipping Durga. That's why I have all this paraphernalia here. So he didn't take it seriously. It's an offense. Noted Ambarish Maharaj. Ambarish Maharaj was praying, fasting with Durvasa Muni Singh. But still, although they got the forgiveness of the devotee, they still had to suffer the reactions. Anything else? So, yes,
is there any occasions where devotees, where they started to chant the holy name, they never actually committed any offences? Is that a general thing that we all...
Yeah, if you're a Nityasiddha devotee, you come here and you've advented yourself specifically to deliver others, then it's possible.
So there are cases of devotees who have not committed any offences?
Yeah, of course.
They chant the pure.
When Advaita Acharya began chanting, I'm sure it was pure.
But he obviously he's Vishnu type of way, and talking about Jiva type
of way. Or like when someone like Shukadeva Goswami, by the time he was born, when he was chanting, it was pure.
Yeah.
They're Nityasiddha devotees.
So, are you saying that the anatha is the offense?
Anartha is cause offense. In other words, as we're covered by anartha is ignorance, and therefore we commit offenses.
But you're not saying that offenses cause anarthas?
Yeah, of course. The word's called good. But when we're talking about nullification of offense, we're talking about something positive. We're going to the nullification. We're not talking about the positive, about committing offenses and therefore becoming covered. Although you may look at it that way also. It's the fact that if you commit offenses against chanting the holy name, you don't go anywhere. Matter of fact, you go the opposite way. But this is something positive they're talking about. This is, we're talking about anartha and vritti, the nullification of it. So due to the, I think aparas are considered, compared to the clouds, and anarthas, the anarthas of ignorance compared to mist. So due to these, that one chants in the state of namabhas. Someone has to become free from both aparas and anartha. Because we're covered by anarthas, bad habits, therefore we commit an aparas. And because we commit aparas, therefore we become covered by more anarthas. So it works both ways. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has explained that about chanting the holy name, let's put this in there. So, can you see if tomorrow you can get some good chalk? Is that possible? You know, does anyone know where to get good chalk around here? Excuse me?
Are you going to see another
class? Tomorrow, we have enough today. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, if one chants the holy name at the stage of Shraddha, then he receives the gift by chanting of his right to chant the holy name. If one has Shraddha, he has the right, he can chant the holy name. And at the stage of Nishtha, when he chants the holy name, along with the name comes the form. So we're chanting the holy name, and spontaneously, along with the holy name, we're remembering Krishna's form, then we can understand we're at the state of Nishtha. And at the state of Ruchi, along with the form, one can taste Krishna's qualities. And at the state of Asakti, along with chanting the name and form qualities, one can spontaneously remember Krishna's pastimes. And at the stage of bhava, one feels the emotion. And at the stage of prema, is feelings of pure love. What's interesting?
The form that you're seeing at the stage of Nishtha, does that mean
that while you're chanting, you can
picture Krishna in your mind? Or does that mean that you're actually seeing him, his form,
in
transcendental vision?
Just like there are seven forms of the deity, so there's a form of the deity within the mind. So, It's not the original, it's not the form of Shama Sundar in the Loka Vrindavan. But just like Prabhupada emphasized, for instance, having the artist paint all these pictures, we place emphasis on deity worship, etc. So the form that one is able to perceive, either by seeing the forms that of Krishna that are pictured for us, made by artists, or else being able to imagine the form within our mind according to authorized descriptions. Ultimately, it's Krishna who's appearing, manifesting himself in some way to us. It's not our imagination that allows us to view Krishna's form. It's Krishna's reciprocating with our imagination and appearing before us within our mind in that way. We can't cause Krishna to appear simply by trying to imagine him, but he agrees to appear if we try to imagine him in that, according to authorized descriptions. Any questions about that? So Prabhupada has made statements like, first try and chant attentively, and then when you can chant attentively, then try to feel Krishna's presence in the holy name. So this holds true for anything. Just like any word we use, it has meaning to us as much as we're able to imagine what's being said. Just like if I use sometimes the example of Mickey Mouse or Donald Duck. So if we hear the name Mickey Mouse, what is it? Immediately, does it bring into mind something? Shama Sundar? What does it bring into mind?
Oh, Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, what does that look like? Something like that. What's it? So, Mickey Mouse. This is not a class on art. and Donald Duck. So immediately, within our mind, we can remember his form. Isn't that right? Then we can remember something about his qualities, his activities, his etc. So, for most words that we use, our mind examines, our intelligence delves into the memory of the mind and brings up what's stored within the memory, different images. Unfortunately, sometimes when we chant Hare Krishna, we remember everything else except for the form of Krishna. So that is due to aparas and anarthas. But our aim is, so when we chant Hare Krishna in a natural way, we remember Shyama Sundara with holding a flute, we remember Srimati Radharani, we remember the Vrindavan, the gopis in the background, the waterfalls, the swans in Vrindavan, the Jamuna River, the creepers in Vrindavan, all these things become remembered by us. So this takes practice. But by practicing it, but it can't be done artificially. In other words, if we chant the holy name and artificially we try to, there is a group of devotees who do that. They use the holy name as like background music, and their real activity is meditation. In other words, they chant the holy name, but their actual activity is to try to remember Krishna's qualities, form, etc. But that would be quite difficult for most of us to do that. Because we may be able to remember for one moment Krishna's form, the next moment our minds will drag us away somewhere else. Is that clear?
When you say some kind of devotees do this practice, means in ISKCON or?
No, it means that there's a class of devotees we'll find in the 15th chapter of the Harinam Chintamani. Of course, in ISKCON also, it's possible anywhere. It's just two different ways of looking at the same thing. Our goal is to fix our mind upon Krishna, and some they try to fix it on Krishna's form directly. We'll find this topic discussed in the Bhajan of Confidential Worship. We'll discuss that about Swarasiki worship and the other types of worship. Yes.
In all these topics are mine and Krishna, but also you say that chanting for all the name is the means and the end. So.
Because Krishna, he manifests himself as the holy name, either through the sound vibration, or in terms of his form, or qualities, pastimes, etc. The actual holy name means Krishna with all everything, with his form, his qualities, his pastimes, the different loving emotions being exchanged between the devotees. That's what the holy name actually means. But we only realize, depending upon our level of advancement, different aspects of the holy name. Therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakura said, they're chanting the holy name, but only the letters of the alphabet are coming. So that's not the holy name, that's the letters of the alphabet. Of course, if you remember K, R, S, that's not so bad. That's not the whole, that's not the complete holy name.
So, in the beginning is by practice that we try to recall these past tense or form. So maybe with photographs we can help ourselves? Is that okay to do that while chanting?
That's better. It's better, of course, to see it. Our aim is not to meditate upon the photograph. Prabhupada didn't seem to like that idea of people meditating on the photograph while they're chanting the holy name. In a sense, not that we shouldn't have a photograph there, but there's a difference between meditating on the photograph and trying to hear the holy name. Now, if we have a photograph before us and we're looking and we're chanting to the photograph, there's nothing wrong with that. But if we're meditating on the photograph rather than the holy name, then we won't be able to hear.
Well, with the eyes, we're not thinking about the photograph. With the eyes, we're seeing the Krishna is doing whatever, and we're hearing the holy name. We can do that.
Yeah, of course. Prabhupada wanted, like in New York, he set up a schedule that the devotees should be able to chant before the deities for an hour at least every day. Unfortunately, they haven't been able to arrange that. The Prabhupada wanted us to chant in front of the deities, for instance. If not, then we have a picture of Krishna, because that is Krishna. So if we chant with a mood, please engage me in your service, then not only, generally, some remembrance of Krishna will arise automatically just by seeing his photo. And if we chant Krishna's name, even more remembrance will come. Go to Navasya.
We have a factor in our center in England, and he somehow has got some realization with the help of another factor that by chanting Om during his japa, that it helps him get the right tone, vibration to feel the holy name. What do you think of this?
Does he still have that opinion? Is that he still?
Yeah. I called up a few days ago, he's still chanting Om.
Well, Om, if he's by chanting Om, he's remembering Krishna and Srimati Radharani and all the different potencies of Krishna. That's all right. But generally, Om is chanted by the impersonalists, addressing Krishna indirectly. Om is just like Krishna's title. But it's also, it says A-U-M are also the names of A being Krishna, U being his internal energy, and M standing for all the living entities. This is a discussion and teachings of Lord Chaitanya about that. So we can't criticize chanting Om, but generally it's addressing Krishna in terms of his title as being the Supreme. So we're not so much interested in that. But Omkar, that's the basic, that's the fundamental, that's the Mahavakya within the Vedas. That is Krishna. But generally when you, as we read in Harinam Chintamani, there's primary names and secondary names. So generally, when people chant Om, they don't take it as a primary name, indicating Krishna's pastimes. Well, although it does, according to teachings of Lord Chaitanya, that's what it actually indicates.
Mm. Now, what is the value of the holy name if one is not initiated?
The same. Everything depends upon... The holy name remains the same. But everything depends upon our consciousness.
Yeah, but still, one needs to receive the Harinam initiation.
Yeah, so that means that...
I mean, it's not only...
Hearing the initiation means the transference of transcendental knowledge from one person to another. Just like Lord Krishna spoke the holy name to the philosophy of Krishna consciousness in the heart of Brahma, and therefore he became enlightened. So in the same way, according to our feeling of surrender to Krishna, and Krishna has given us the process that one has to become a devotee of his devotee, one has to develop that feeling of surrender to his devotee. So if we have that feeling of surrender, absolute surrender, according to our degree of feeling of surrender to one of Krishna's representatives, to that degree Krishna reveals himself to us. So chanting the holy name depends upon the feeling of attention and surrender that we have. So that has to be something practical.
Yeah, but still, I mean, the sacrifice is necessary.
Those that are just like, if you get married for the sake of authorization, then you have a marriage ceremony. But in Vedic culture, where people are not so whimsical as we are, it wasn't always necessary. Marriage, there were 7 different types of marriages, Gandharva, Rakshasha, so many different types of marriages. But generally marriage is limited nowadays to, you know, the formal wedding. But people don't even take that seriously. So similarly, initiation, previously, it wasn't that Lord Krishna had a fire sacrifice with Lord Brahma and then gave him initiation.
No, but it's different personalities, I mean, but the...
Or even...
People who join the ISKCON, they're not Brahman.
Therefore, the formal ceremony is the outcome of the feeling of surrender, of a certain stage of that feeling of surrender. So it's not, initiation is the beginning, but without that feeling of, without that being initiated or that feeling of surrender, then it's, we have to, by chanting the holy name, we can come to that feeling. The more we sincerely chant, then the more we can come to that stage of feeling like that.
I just want to comment that even up to, until the time of Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, the fire sacrifices weren't so commonly performed in Vaishnava initiations. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati kind of reintroduced it on a larger scale. So even up until, say, 200 years ago, it wasn't that common. The initiation is seen more in terms of, like you're speaking, the internal realization between the disciple and the spiritual master.
Yeah. But in those times, the disciples say, I'm your surrendered servant, and the spiritual master say, I accept you, and that would be it. Then it would go on like that. People, when they made a statement, it had some meaning. But nowadays, people don't, you know, they don't always mean like that. They change their minds. You know, people can't take, things have to be written down or something. Therefore, more formalities are added just to check our tendency to be a little devious. Therefore, there's a fire sacrifice in front of the devotees, in front of the deities, in front of so many things. One is making a vow before. And so maybe, if he's not a rascal and a hypocrite, maybe he'll take it seriously. People don't know what the value of the word. If you say something and then you don't follow it through, people don't realize the reaction that you get for it. Because they say so many lies, they cheat so much, that their whole life has simply become, you know, one devious activity after another. They don't realize in the next lifetime they have to suffer the results of that, or even in this lifetime. Anything else about this?
Well, if initiation involves a transference of knowledge, and ultimately it's really the consciousness of the disciple. So, as been said before, one would say, well, I'm receiving knowledge from Srila Prabhupada through his books, his tapes, etc. So, what is the need for another form of initiation?
Well, because if you receive knowledge from Prabhupada's books, and Prabhupada's books says that you have to have a living spiritual master to surrender to. So if you're actually obtaining knowledge from Prabhupada's books, then you'll find someone that you actually develop that feeling of surrender. Because the books won't tell you that you're a rascal and you have to do this, so why are you doing that? You know, the books are rather neutral. Therefore, one has to find a Mahajan and follow his footsteps, his instructions. So Prabhupada writes in his books, book knowledge alone is not sufficient in 434, that one has to surrender to the spiritual master. So just books are not sufficient. When therefore Prabhupada not only wrote his books, he created a society that we can learn how to practice his books in.
It's been explained to me, and Srila Prabhupada states himself, that initiation is a process that begins from the moment you hear from the spiritual master. So if we look at initiation as something that's not confined to a specific time and place, but a process that we're performing throughout our lives, then we can say that when we do read Srila Prabhupada's books, that is a part of our process of initiation. And when we associate with the devotees, that is also a part of our process of initiation. It's an ongoing process. Initiation is
what do you mean by how does that differentiate between formally accepting? I mean, there is a stage of the process where you formally accept someone as your Diksha Guru.
Right, that's another part of the process, but that it's not limited to that particular time when you partake of the fire sacrifice.
Well, it's true in the sense, just like, for instance, if you're learning how to cook, or how to fly an airplane. So on the ground, you receive so much instruction on how to fly an airplane, and finally you're up in the air and you're getting some practical experience. So you can't say flying the airplane is just limited to your flying in the sky, because you receive so much previous training that helped you do it. But in another sense, if you receive all the previous training and you don't fly an airplane on the airplane, what was the value of all the previous training?
The flying can be compared then to Nusamabhati, that point at which we actually get the transcendental knowledge, which is Krishna. So it's not that at the time of the fire sacrifice that we're getting Nusamabhati. The process still goes on.
Of course, it is a process. In other words, when we approach it, when we obtain some shraddha, maybe after some agyata sukriti, etc., then we obtain some shraddha, some faith, that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, I am His eternal servant, that my real goal in life is to follow all the instructions, to become surrendered to Krishna. And then we associate with the devotees, sadhu sangha, and in their association we learn what is the process of surrender. So up to that time, we have the real process of surrender is really the feeling of surrendering to Krishna. We're trying to develop that feeling, because Krishna is not really, we're not advancing simply by externally performing the activity. We're advancing as much as we develop the feeling of surrender, sharanagrati. So the more we have that feeling, because that feeling has to be directed towards Krishna or Krishna's representative. But to find out, as Prabhupada writes in 1857, is Rajavihari Guruji, quoting that verse, that order of Krishna comes down through the disciple succession from the bona fide spiritual master. Therefore, the bona fide spiritual master should be accepted as one prime duty of life. So if one gets a bona fide spiritual master and acts according to his direction, then his success in life and Krishna consciousness is guaranteed. So we have to know what Krishna wants us to do before we do something. If we don't know whether this is pleasing to Krishna or not, then that's called acting whimsically. If we just do something not knowing whether it's pleasing to Krishna. So there has to be some representative of Krishna who's telling us what's pleasing to Krishna and what's not pleasing to Krishna. And if we follow his directions with a spirit of trying to please Krishna, then that is pleasing to Krishna. That's called surrender, to develop that feeling. Is that clear? So there has to be someone who we have faith in, who is telling us what is pleasing to Krishna, what's not pleasing to Krishna, and we're developing that feeling of surrender towards those instructions. Is that clear? But even if I accept formally, I accept initiation, but I don't develop that feeling, then it's simply a waste of time. On the other hand, even if sometimes it's found that even without formal initiation, one can have that, develop that feeling. But that feeling has to be developed towards someone, towards a person, some representative of Krishna. Here in the Harinam Chintamani, in the second chapter, it talks about descendants of the different Vaishnavas. That first class Vaishnava is whom? Well, let's start, I have to start over switch to the third class Vaishnava. Who's the third class Vaishnava? Let's tell you. Who's the third class Vaishnava? What are the descendants of the Harinam Chintamani, second chapter?
Anyone
give a chance to the holy name? Yeah. When is chanting the holy name is considered to be on the third class Vaishnava? And who's the second class Vaishnava?
One people
constantly chants Hare. So that's not, second class is not so easy. And first class, Uttama Bhakta, Chamasundara?
Inspired others to chant.
Yes, he inspires others to chant. Just like Haridas Thakur, he was chanting, even though he was a young prostitute, but instead of seducing Haridas Thakur, she became a Vaishnavi and gave up everything and joined Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. Certainly, Srila Prabhupada, just by his presence, he actually invoked transcendental emotions within others. I remember sometimes seeing Prabhupada, so the whole atmosphere would become transformed into Vaikuntha. So everyone was like amazed by his transcendental presence. So that is the idea, when the pure devotee, he chants the holy name, not only is the name there, but the form of Krishna is there, his qualities are manifest, his transcendental pastimes are manifest. And therefore, Bhavati Das Bhagavatas Tirtham Bhutak Swayam Vibho Tirti Tirtani Bhutani Swantak Stena Katavritaha. Vidura was, Marajudas there told Vidura that saints like yourself, they're verily holy places personified. Because wherever you go, that place becomes converted into a holy place because you carry within your heart the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So the more we are able to manifest, the more Krishna manifests as a response to our chanting purely, then the more the whole atmosphere becomes purified by Krishna's presence, along with his eternal associates, etc. Then the spiritual identity of the holy name, that Krishna and his name are identical. So when we're chanting the holy name, if Krishna's form, quality, pastimes are not there, it's not that Krishna is not there, Krishna is everywhere. It's just that we're not aware of him simply by chanting the holy name. We're actually not aware of the holy name yet. And the holy name is all attractive. Then the 64 attributes are listed for Krishna. So, remembrance of Krishna's name or his form or his qualities is on the absolute level. Similarly, his pastimes. Therefore, for instance, in the Krishna book class I used to teach, that when we're reading the Krishna book, we should actively try to imagine what's being said. That's not speculation. That's actually the proper use of our imagination. For instance, in the story of... I'll tell one of the pastimes, so it'll be easier to... The gopis used to talk about Krishna among themselves, and their talks were as follows. One gopi said... That Krishna is so beautiful, let's see. That Krishna is so beautiful, that when Krishna lies on the ground, he rests on his left elbow and he rests his head in his left palm. The beautiful Krishna moves his attractive eyebrows while playing his flute with his delicate fingers. And the sound vibration produces such a nice atmosphere that the denizens of heaven who are flying overhead with their wives and beloved stop their airplanes because they're stunned by the vibration of the flute. The wives of the demigods who are seated in the airplane become embarrassed over their musical and singing qualifications. And not only that, but due to conjugal affliction, their tightened dresses and hair immediately loosen. Another gopi said, that Krishna is so beautiful that the goddess of fortune always remains on his chest, And he's always adorned with a golden necklace. Beautiful Krishna, he plays on his flute just to enliven the hearts of many devotees. He's the only friend of the suffering living entities. When he plays on his flute, the cows and the other animals in Vrindavan who engage in eating simply take a morsel of food in their mouths and they stop chewing. The ears raise up and they become stunned. They do not appear alive, but like painted animals. That even the animals of Vrindavan are attracted by Krishna's flute. And what to speak of ourselves. So if we try to imagine seeing a cow, just like there are so many cows here, this is the nice thing about being in Vrindavan. If you grew up in a city all day, throughout your whole life, and all you saw was buses and trains going by the whole day, you heard these pastimes, you'd see Rolls Royce or something. But here in Vrindavan, there's so many cows. We can imagine Krishna. He's playing on his flute, resting on his left elbow, and resting his head in his left palm, and moving his attractive eyebrows while playing his flute with his delicate fingers. And then all the denizens of heaven are flying overhead, or they're becoming stunned by the vibration of the flute, or the cows becoming stunned and the other animals are eating. So in this way, by using our imagination, we actually can experience Krishna consciousness. It doesn't remain simply some theoretical, something to experience in the future that's theoretical, but it becomes part of one's practical everyday Krishna conscious experience. Is that clear? So, any questions about this? So the holy name is the fountainhead. So this is the point I was making. Of the four characteristic features, name, form, qualities, and activities, the Lord's holy name is the original because it rewards cognition of the other three. Therefore, chanting the holy name is the prime religious activity of a Vaishnava. From the holy name, gratitude blossoms the Lord's form, qualities, and pastimes. The entire panorama of Krishna's pastimes is present in the holy name. You have personally declared that your name is the highest absolute truth. But we shouldn't become discouraged when we're chanting and it seems that our mind is wandering. That it's not, Krishna consciousness is not a process of trying to control the mind. It's the process of trying to hear and chant the holy name. The mind simply serves as a distraction in that activity. So although our mind may be wandering, if we're steadily trying to chant and hear, that if we steadily try just to chant more clearly and to hear with more attention, then the result is that gradually one makes progress. And that progress manifests in that if we chant purely with some attention and feeling, then gradually the holy name, the form will be remembered. Then the qualities, etc. But not that we're trying to make our minds perfect without any disturbance. That's not possible. So therefore, one should become aloof from the mind by the process of neglect. That one should not become disturbed or attached to the mind in any way. One should simply chant and hear nicely. Is that clear? Otherwise, if our mind's going off on some tangent and we become disturbed, either attracted to it or disturbed by it, then we won't be able to hear the holy name. So wherever the mind goes to, that one should simply let it go, and simply concentrate on chanting and hearing properly.
What is meant then by beating the mind with a wooden stick or a wooden shoe?
That means that one should neglect the mind.
You shouldn't fight?
No, otherwise you get entangled in the mind, then there's no end to it. Attachment and aversion are the same thing. Therefore, Krishna says, Raga dvesha vimukta astu vishana indriya astaran atma vaishara videya mahaprasana adivakshiti. That when one is actually immersed in Krishna consciousness, then automatically becomes free from all attachment and aversion caused by the mind. So one should simply run for Krishna, try to obtain Krishna consciousness, and then automatically all attachment and aversion arising from the mind will go away.
What's the reference
to my test? 264. Bhagavad Gita. Alright, so we'll stop there. Please continue reading. Tomorrow we'll go over more completely the Harinam Chintamani, and then the Nectar of Instruction.
Do you have a test on Friday?
Yes, there's a test on Friday.